Diverse Open Doors Day, 26th of February. Learn more about the many faiths in the city.
BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Postponed from last week, Bill Gates is pouring money into geoengineering to prepare for climate change. But what does Bill need earthquake bombs for? Islamic think tank Global Vision 2000 believes the old colonial system has been replaced by a secretive global financial cartel, which has the same effect, that is, stripping small nations of their natural resources. We examine possible economic motives for the wars in Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Plus another look at who really runs the world, examines the dangers of combined power of the media and the police when, as in the phone hacking scandal, it turns criminal. Well, apologies for not having our discussion on MP Jack Lopresti and his Freemasonry this week. Jerry Coulter, who runs sites exposing Freemasonic corruption, they are DorsetPolice.com and DorsetVictimSupport.com, couldn't make it this week, so we hope he can in a few weeks' time. But now, the misdiagnosis scandal at the University Hospital's Bristol NHS Trust, that's mainly the BRI to you and there are some other hospitals too, but rather than investigate and improve, there are some who say the Trust is ruled from the top by a cover-up culture. To discuss this, I'm joined by Daphne Habercroft from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. Hi, Daphne, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for inviting me back.
Now, first of all, I did ask UHB NHS Trust's Chief Executive and Chairman John Savage if they'd like to come on the radio tonight to put their point of view, but the Trust didn't return my phone calls. But so first, Daphne, tell us about last night's meeting. And this is actually the other Trust, isn't it? Bristol Trust.
Well, it was yesterday morning, and a couple of us went up to North Bristol NHS Trust for their board meeting because in the Evening Post this week and also in the Telegraph last weekend, there was a piece about the possible true rate of misdiagnoses, and buried away in the inquiry report that was produced in December 2010, if you look at the figures, it indicates that it is possible that over a 10-year period that the inquiry was supposed to have looked at, 2000 to 2009 inclusive, there could have been at least 6,800 serious errors. Now, that's a hypothesis. The NHS knows about it. I would think, if I was the NHS, I would very quickly want to refute it with evidence if I had it, or say, yeah, fair cop, we have a problem, and do a bit more further investigation into what's been actually going on.
Okay, can you tell us how this kind of misdiagnosis takes place in the first place? How does it actually happen? I mean, surely there are some pretty strict procedures about how diagnoses are come to.
Yeah, well, I mean, errors, everybody makes errors, human beings make errors, but the sort of errors we're talking about are at the more serious end of the scale, where pathologists who look at tissue on slides in a laboratory may not pick up a cancer, or they may say that something is cancerous and it's not. And there should be safeguards in place to make sure, because it is a question of interpretation, that if it's a bit difficult, if they're not sure, they can carry out further tests, get a colleague to look at it, get an expert from elsewhere to look at it. And it's the evidence in the inquiry's own report is that the labs at the BRI were not seeking other opinions when it seemed appropriate that they ought to, and there's some evidence that they were not carrying out further tests when it would have seemed appropriate for them to do so.
So what's the timeline on this, and has it been put right?
No, it hasn't been put right. The concerns were first raised going back to 2000. The first, I think, documented evidence about it is 2004, and the concerns possibly go right up to the present time. There was certainly a misdiagnosis within about a week or so after the inquiry report was issued. And the Royal College of Pathologists back in 2009 told the two medical directors at North Bristol and at University Hospitals Bristol that to investigate allegations of poor professional performance, a proper independent review of a significant sample of appropriately selected cases should be commissioned, and it wasn't. So instead, money was spent on this inquiry, which is completely unaccountable to the public. It's supposed to be a...
Yeah, but isn't it published?
The inquiry is published, but the interviews were all conducted in secret. And the actual inquiry itself, the University Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust keeps going on about it being an independent inquiry. Well, they commissioned it, they paid for it, and they agreed the terms of reference. So how is that independent of them?
But, I mean, surely it's quite important to keep submissions to such an inquiry confidential. You wouldn't want to necessarily, if people didn't want their names given, that kind of thing, to be put on there.
Well, there is an element of that, but there are typically four types of NHS inquiry, and this one doesn't fit any of them. You've got an internal inquiry, which is conducted by NHS managers, so it wasn't that. You've got inquiries that are conducted or ordered by the Secretary of State, so it wasn't that. You've got inquiries that are conducted by regulators like the Care Quality Commission, and it wasn't one of those. And this seems to be a sort of hybrid thing where it looks like an internal inquiry, but they brought in some people from outside to try and give it some independent status. But it doesn't wash. It was paid for by them. They agreed the terms of reference, and it didn't investigate why senior members of the board didn't take action when they knew about these allegations.
So how do you arrive at this rather alarming figure of possible misdiagnoses, in the thousands?
Well, it's based on the number of cases that they review over 10 years. So the Trust says that it's about 20,000 cases per year they report on. Buried away in the inquiry's own report, it talks about, if you look at the figures, you can extrapolate a 3.4% error rate. So if you assume that error rate applies to the whole workload over 10 years, that's 200,000 reports they did. 3.4% is 6,800. So it's a hypothesis based on figures that are in their own report. And that any hypothesis should be tested to see whether it's valid or not. But all they're doing is just sitting there, and what they've said is that they're implying that there were only a few errors over that 10-year period. They never did any sampling of the workload over that 10-year period to be able to say how many errors there might have been.
Well, although we did ask them to appear today, they didn't get back to me on the phone. So the university, and one of the, they do comment though in the Bristol Evening Post's article, University Hospitals Bristol's NHS Foundation Trust, which runs the BRI, told a national newspaper, that's the Telegraph, that it had accepted the inquiry's findings and focused on implementing the recommendations. An anonymous spokesman for the Trust said the inquiry's independent panel found no evidence to suggest the department was not safe. Now, I understand, Daphne, that the inquiry panel's reconvening in a week or so.
Yeah, they're coming back to Bristol at more public expense to review the Trust's progress in implementing their recommendations.
But you say at the Trust's expense, but surely an inquiry panel, you know, it should be publicly funded, shouldn't it?
It should if it's a properly constituted inquiry, and our view is that this one wasn't. It was a fudge. So they're coming back to review the progress with their recommendations. They have asked us to, or invited us to be interviewed about it, and we have agreed, although we did have this strange letter from the management company that is handling all this for them, this company called Verita, a management consultancy, which seemed to imply that if they felt minded to do so, they could criticise us as members of the public. So we said, well, no, we're not signing up to anything that involves that. So this meeting is taking place on the 1st of March. But we're not allowed to say anything about the past or anything about our concerns about the inquiry. So they don't want to discuss any of the issues we raise, any questions about, well, actually, you've implied in your report that there are only a few serious errors, but buried away in your report, if you analyse it, there could be many thousands of errors. So how are you going to deal with that? They don't want, well, they won't discuss any of that.
These misdiagnoses, they refer to tissue samples which are being diagnosed by the BRI. Can you just give us an idea of the types of diagnosis they're doing? What kind of things are they screening for?
Well, it's things like breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung disease, for example, mesothelioma.
Right, so idea is that these are early intervention and it's absolutely crucial that they get it right.
Yeah, I mean, particularly if you look at screening programmes, cancer screening programmes, like breast and cervical screening, where people who don't have symptoms are called and invited to be screened. Some will unfortunately be recalled if the scan or the screening shows that there might be something wrong. And then the doctor might decide to take a tissue sample to send off to see whether it's cancerous or not. But people who use those programmes put their faith that the whole intervention, that the doctors will get it right. And okay, it's not a perfect science, but if they're not sure, that they will actually seek other opinions, do further testing to make sure that they get the best, the most accurate result for that patient.
But I'm sure, Daphne, if someone were from University Hospitals Bristol Trust had come along tonight, they would be saying to you, of course, there's always bound to be a certain degree of error.
And I would say, yes, but it's how you deal with the error and it's the degree of seriousness of the error. And what the doctors who raise concerns in Bristol have said is that these errors were being made by consultant pathologists at a cancer centre, or what they call a tertiary referral centre. So it's a regional centre for referral of more complex cases. And it's there in the inquiry's own report that they were not sending specimens out for other opinions. Somebody was quoted in the report as saying it was like visiting a department about 15, 20 years ago, that their standards, they had not kept up with modern developments. The inquiry bizarrely concluded, overall, we've seen nothing to suggest anything other than a safe service. If they're operating or have been operating in a way that is 15, 20 years behind the times, how is that safe?
So if the inquiry was constituted properly rather than improperly, how would it have looked? How would it have been different to the inquiry that the Trust did actually institute here?
It would have been constituted or commissioned by a body that was not the Trust under investigation. In a way, it's a bit like almost inviting a suspected criminal to work the crime scene.
Interesting. Martin, the chap who's in charge here of this particular trust, UHB Trust, is John Savage. I mean, he's a business leader. He's the business leader for the whole of the southwest of England. Business West, John Savage. He's also a merchant venturer. It seems that maybe here what we've got, you know, possibly anyway, is a kind of business approach to what is actually a public service.
Well, I mean, I'm listening very carefully to what Daphne's saying. I mean, it's a transparency issue, isn't it? It's not a question of I mean, obviously, I don't believe in a privatised NHS, and I can make general points about the economy.
But that is how businesses operate, isn't it? With much more secrecy than these public bodies.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the whole thing of competition, if you like, where people are running a trust and they've got a brand that they've got to keep up, and otherwise it looks as if they're failing, and they're being compared with other brands who are in other parts of the country. I mean, there's always going to be a tendency for any system for mistakes to be made, and for those who've made those mistakes to try and cover up for it. And that happens all over the place, in the public and the private sector.
Definitely. Do you think it's fair for me to say that this sounds like a sort of private sector approach to a public sector problem?
Yeah, potentially. Although I work in the private sector, and I have to say that the sort of culture I work in, it ain't as secretive as the NHS. Mm. But interesting with the merchant venturer connection, the chair of North Bristol NHS Trust, Peter Rylett, is also a merchant venturer, and NBT is where the BRI was a few years ago and now aspiring to achieve Foundation Trust status. And so what they are doing is busy integrating pathology teams from across the city, and they don't want anything like this, these unresolved concerns about the histopathology inquiry rocking their boat to get Foundation Trust status. And we're getting the same sort of reaction from North Bristol as we are from UH Bristol. They don't want to answer these questions. It's a, you know, a big cover-up as far as we're concerned.
Martin, the merchant ventures originally, in their original form, were the slave traders of the city, you know, making lots of money out of the slave trade, although making sure, of course, that none of the evidence actually came to the city. Do you think there's a case here for questioning powerful groups like the merchants? Well, because it does seem that they've got, you know, it may be just coincidence that all people that rise in the city to these powerful positions join the merchants, or are invited to join, or it may be the other way around.
Well, I think that you've got to distinguish here between, you know, the issue around privatisation and whether businessmen should be running hospitals. I mean, I presume in the past, before Foundation Trusts came along, and you had a bureaucracy, there would be civil servants running these things, wouldn't they? And there'd be career civil servants who knew what the health service was about. And most of what they did was probably... I mean, the problem with any structure is there is a tendency for people to try and cover up mistakes, whatever you're doing. And we could argue... I mean, obviously, I don't believe in privatising the health service. I am worried about what's going to happen with it, but that's not directly bearing on this, although it does bear in the way that Daphne suggested, is that they don't want to look at past stuff because they've got this whole future of you know, competition or whatever to come, and the money to be made, and the last thing they want to do is go back through all of this and drag up all of this can of worms. But well, I mean, ultimately, you know, this is health, and it needs to be transparent. If mistakes are made, we need to know what's going on.
I think there's a potential conflict of interest, because the non-executive board members, and that includes the chairs, their role is to hold the executive board members to account on behalf of the local community. Mm-hmm. We saw this at North Bristol yesterday, because we went to North Bristol, the board there, to actually question them on the number of misdiagnoses. And what we said to them is, well, the inquiry report doesn't stand up to scrutiny. You, the non-execs, including the chair, are supposed to hold the execs to account. So what are you going to do to make sure that there is a proper review of what's been going on? And they did nothing, just handed it over to the North Bristol Medical Director, Chris Burton, to reply. And he did the old line about, well, the same as we get from the BRI, that the inquiry was reasonably constituted. No, it wasn't. That it undertook a thorough review. No, it didn't, because it didn't look at what the board did when they knew about these concerns. And so we're getting exactly the same reaction up the road as we are down here.
Okay, Daphne, so you mentioned this, I mentioned this meeting on the 1st of March. Is that something for the public can come to as the inquiry panel comes back to Bristol?
Oh, no, you cannot go there unless you've got an appointment to see them. We have asked that our transcript is not marked confidential. Their normal process is that when they interview people, they mark the transcript private and confidential to the panel, and we've said no, anything that we have to say to them and then to us, it's a matter of public interest, and it should be made public.
Well, let's hope that goes well next Thursday. Would you just like to plug your organisation, which is, when you say we, you don't mean the royal we, you mean Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group.
Yes.
So how does one get in touch with them? With you?
Well, you get in touch with us. You can call us on 07971968244, or you can email us at swwhistleblowers, that's one word, @gmail.com.
And your website?
It's
by the way, I will put a link up to this website after the show on tonight's podcast.
Okay. It's swag.wordpress.com.
swhag.wordpress.com. Well, yeah. Daphne Havercroft, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, Martin Summers stays with us as we look at world events. Specifically, though, this time, we were meaning to do it last week, we're doing it this week, is geoengineering. Martin, what is geoengineering and why is Bill Gates spending a lot of money on it?
Well, I can't claim I know an awful lot about this. It was drawn to our attention by one of our fans in Brussels who sent us an email. We do have listeners in Brussels. If you're listening, Gail Lagarde, hello to you. Thanks for your feedback. And she pointed out articles in Environment Guardian about geoengineering, and geoengineering is being pushed forward as a solution to climate change. So it's things like, you know, perhaps putting mirrors into space to reflect the sun's rays, you know, all sorts of stuff like that, which doesn't involve reducing carbon footprints. And Bill Gates has put lots of money into it. But what the article rather worryingly points out is that the military have been researching this stuff for years. And the climate change aspect of it has only recently come forward. And it's rather worrying that the military have in fact been experimenting with things like causing earthquakes, and it looks as if they have.
One of the extract from the article, it says, pressure to find a quick technological fix to climate change is growing as politicians fail to reach an agreement to significantly reduce emissions. In 2009 to 2010, the US government received requests for over $2 billion, that's £1.2 billion, of grants for geoengineering research, but spent only $100 million. The pressure is on, Martin, to find technological fixes.
Well, I mean, obviously, to my mind, this is silly. I mean, it's throwing good money after bad. It's like,
but we've
Star
got to do
Wars.
Something about climate change, surely.
Well, maybe
if
we do,
these international agreements aren't being reached.
There aren't technical fixes to fix it like that. It's just a boondoggle. I mean, somebody will just make a whole load of money out of it, but whether it'll work or not's another matter. But I think more worrying to me is the fact that the military have been experimenting with this stuff for years for their own purposes. So, you know, there was a rumour, for example, spread originated with the Russian Navy, because the Russian Navy have got a carrier battle group in the Caribbean. They told people in Venezuela, and the Venezuelans then whispered it onto the internet, that there may be some aspects to do with the Haiti earthquake may not be entirely accidental. Now, I don't normally listen to that kind of talk, but when it's sourced with the Russian Navy, my ears prick up.
Okay, so it sounds like these earthquake bombs could feasibly be out there. You know, this is almost one of those things that you think is a conspiracy theory, and you must be an Illuminati nutcase
if you think about it. It's not that difficult to trigger an earthquake. The question is, are you evil enough to do something like that?
But, I suppose if you can keep it secret, you may be tempted to do so. What could be the possible military advantage, though?
Well, don't forget, Haiti, if we're talking about the Haiti earthquake in that particular case, there's a massive amount of oil just off Port-au-Prince. It's been discovered some years ago. The Lavalas movement led by Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide was very popular in Haiti. They wanted to use that oil to build, basically a more fair and equal society in Haiti. But powerful forces did not want that to happen. So we've had Bill Clinton in Haiti this couple of weeks ago shaking hands with baby Doc Duvalier, who's also come back. And they had a sort of an election about a year ago, which about 20% of the population participated. An American stooge was elected, and Lavalas were not allowed to run. And if you're going to go to that length to keep control of Haiti, why wouldn't you do an earthquake on them as well? I'm not saying that the Americans did do an earthquake on Haiti. I'm just saying that the rumour from the Russian Navy was that that's what had happened. Now, well, maybe the Russian Navy are just being mischievous.
Well, one thing here is it's very interesting that this does expose that the military certainly have been trying out this idea.
Well, if you think about it logically, it's not that difficult to create earthquakes. You know, you can do it. If you think about it, it's just an explosives business.
What about the Japanese earthquake? Do you think that we should be thinking in terms whenever we see a major earthquake there's potential here for this to be a military operation?
By and large, because I've got such an interest in false flag terrorism and like bombings and shootings and so on, I don't go down the road of looking into geological events as being caused, because it queers the pitch. But I mean, Gail has raised this issue, and we have addressed it. I mean, it does seem that there is some pressure to move in this direction, and the climate change, you know, Bill Gates giving money to develop these things as part of climate change, it's kind of almost, you know, they're ready to tell people now that they can, in fact, fiddle with the climate and change geology, and they're using climate change as the means of explaining to people what they're up to. But the military have been up to it for years. I mean, even if you don't make earthquakes, you can learn how to make them, and no doubt the Russians have been experimenting with similar.
I mean, are we talking here about potentially some kind of thing that drills into the ground with a nuclear weapon?
Well, it doesn't have to be a nuclear weapon, does it? You use a big conventional explosive. If you put it on a fault line, you're quite likely to cause an earthquake, aren't you?
Okay, well, also moving on to discuss the Middle East. Martin, we've had more on Syria. This, I mean, in the news almost every day. We've also had the death of these two journalists in Homs. What are your thoughts about the way things are going? Because we've got a referendum on Sunday. The Americans have said that this referendum is laughable. Do you think it's laughable?
Well, we'll see. I presume the calculation by the Assad regime is if they can get 50% of the people to come out and vote in favour of their reform programme, they will then demonstrate to the world that they have political support. Now, whether the vote is going to be free and fair, obviously it's difficult to have a free and fair vote in the middle of a civil war when people are killing each other. So in a way, it's a kind of a last throw of the dice by Assad in one sense. But of course, his regime is not necessarily going to crumble. It's not clear that the rebels are fighting against him, and they are armed rebels. I mean, the idea that these people are peaceful protesters waving banners is ludicrous. I mean, Homs is in the same position now as Fallujah was when it was being attacked by the US Marines. And there's people inside Homs, as there were people inside Fallujah, who were armed and fighting back. And if you read the international press, they're talking about all sorts of NATO weaponry being taken in there, including Milan anti-tank missiles.
Well, we've also had John McCain, who was the Republican candidate for the US presidency the last time round, saying we really should be just dropping as many arms as we can into the rebels.
Well, they're already doing that. It's quite clear. The Saudis and the Qataris, for example, have no scruples about arming people up inside Syria. And of course, there were the bombs in Aleppo at the police headquarters that killed 20 or 30 people, claimed by Al-Qaeda. Ayman al-Zahiri saying we want all of our fighters from Iraq to go into Syria to overthrow the Assad regime. Now, of course, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group are also reputedly sending people to Turkey. Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who was the military governor of Tripoli, is now fighting with the Free Syrian Army he's based in Turkey, but people are going over the border into Syria. I mean, the situation, frankly, is extremely dangerous. The stuff I've been reading suggests that British and French special forces are already on the ground inside Syria. The Russians have sent Spetsnaz forces there. The Iranians and the Russians have both got a carrier battle group based at Tarsus, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard may be sending people in as well. So we could have British soldiers shooting up the Iranian Revolutionary Guard tomorrow, and that could be a casus belli for a major war with Iran, and off we go. Oil price through the roof, banking collapse, major war right across the Middle East, and nobody seems to be able to stop it now. Well, even if they wanted to.
Well, one thing we've had in the announcement today, that William Hague at the Foreign Office has decided that the British, anyway, now diplomatically are going to recognise the Syrian rebels.
Well, I mean, what the Russians and the Chinese are saying, well, let's get everybody, if there are rebels and there is a government, why don't we call a ceasefire and get everybody around the table? But of course, during the Libyan business and the Free Syrian Army now, they're being advised by William Hague and the West not to negotiate with Assad. So Assad's got no... I mean, they're being told not to negotiate, fine. Well, Assad says, I'm not going to negotiate with you, I'm going to crush you, just like the US Marines crushed the rebellion in Fallujah. It took them weeks, took them months, but they killed their way in there, killed thousands of people, and they put their boot down, and that crushed that. And no doubt Assad's going to take exactly the same line as the US Marines did in Fallujah.
What about Somalia, though? Because we had a big conference in London yesterday with Prince Charles winging his way over to talk to the president. I think he's called Good Luck Jonathan, isn't he?
No, that's Nigeria.
Oh, is it? Okay. No. Sorry, but anyway, there was a president on there was a conference yesterday on Somalia. So what's happening there?
Well, there's obviously many Somalis in Bristol, so they will know better than I what the situation on the ground is, because they presumably have contacts with family and friends over there. It's a tragedy, a huge tragedy. I mean, the Islamic Courts Union, which basically took over Mogadishu a few years ago, was an Islamic movement, but they basically brought security to the streets of Mogadishu after years and years of clan warfare. And it was the Islamic Courts Union was not flavour of the month for the Western powers, so they put the Ethiopians up to invade Somalia and remove them, which they did. And you've now got the Al-Shabaab movement, which is a kind of more extreme version of the Islamic Courts Union, fighting the Western-backed transitional government. And of course, people are dying left, right and centre. Kenya's invaded from the south. Drones are being sent in there to take out so-called Al-Qaeda operatives and whatever. There's a lot of oil in Somalia, actually, particularly in Puntland. This is what people don't realise, just like Haiti. And
but it's also strategic, isn't it?
Oh, it's
of course, because
place,
of,
yeah.
because I mean, we've
right
seen these. I don't know if people have been online. You will have seen these maps of Iran in the middle of the map, and then all the way around, apart from just to the north, perhaps, which is the former Soviet Union places where that borders onto Iran. Everywhere, pretty much now around Iran, is surrounded by American bases.
Well, yes. And of course, what we could have here is an uncontrollable war, which will run from Syria to Iran to Somalia to Yemen, into Central Asia, Afghanistan, of course, where loads of protests has been shot down this week by the US military protesting against burning of Korans. Iraq, people, loads of bombings and shootings still going on in Iraq. We've got bored of listening to it now. Iraqi Sunni militants are infiltrating Syria. The Saudis are supporting the Sunni insurgency in Syria and probably supporting the Sunni insurgency in Iraq. The Iranians are supporting their protégés. The potential, the Israelis are beating the drum for war. The former heads of Mossad are saying, let's not do it, but a lot of the politicians are still getting very hot under the collar. The American Republican primaries, they're all falling over each other, apart from Ron Paul, to say when we're going to bomb Iran. We could end up with a war with Iran before the end of next month and a banking collapse simultaneously, which would push the oil price through the roof, collapse the banks, and millions dead. And it could be a nuclear war.
And isn't war inevitable? I mean, we have a First World War, a Second World War. It's been a while since we've had a big war, isn't it?
Yep. That's got to be the fear, hasn't it? And the Russians have made it absolutely clear that any attempt to put a no-fly zone in Iraq will be resisted by their air force. They've got an aircraft carrier down there with Russian planes on it.
It does seem...
So if the RAF try to cross into Syrian airspace, they're going to be in dogfights with the Russians.
It seems fascinating to me that you've got all this tension rising in the Middle East, particularly around Syria or Iran right now, at the same time as all this problem with the euro in the eurozone. Well, money and war, how are they linked?
It's a bit bizarre because the main people who supply the Greeks, for example, most Greek oil comes from Iran, and they buy it on credit, and they've been told that they can't buy on credit from the Iranians anymore. So we're going through this hot, in one room you've got the finance ministers twisting arms to try and get a bailout sorted for the Greeks, and in another room you've got the foreign ministers cutting off their oil supply, which is basically going to make all of the finance ministers' work pointless, because if the oil price goes up, it's about $110 at the moment, but if fighting started, it would soon shoot up to $200, which will absolutely crash the euro. No ifs, no buts, it will go down, and the banking system will go down simultaneously. And this is the danger, you see. We're going to get world war and banking collapse simultaneously. In World War II, you had a banking collapse and a war that followed with a time lag. We're going to have them both simultaneously if we're not too unlucky. Or we're going to be unlucky.
Unlucky. Is it all about luck? A roll of the dice?
Well, no. To be honest with you, my honest assessment is that we are going to have a world war and a banking collapse, and I'm not very happy about it. But I mean, all the signs are there. I mean, you know, you'd be a fool not to recognise it.
Well, many are now seeing the Greek debt negotiations as something akin to a loan shark getting as much as he can from his victim and threatening to send the boys round. One of those is Islamic think tank Global Vision 2000, and they believe in debt-free and interest-free money, much like the Christian law used to demand in this country under usury laws, which were repealed in Britain in 1854. Anyway, here is Mohin Yassin from Global Vision 2000.
After the collapse of so-called direct imperialism, after the imperialists left and their backers, a new global cage to enslave. Now, I can mention the names. You've got the UN, right. IMF, World Bank, WTO, right. The private cartel, the banks. They have a shadow world government. They meet at places like Davos. It's by invitation of a certain type of people. Also, we also know that formal financial architecture has a shadow. For instance, you've got groups like Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Commission. Have you heard of these names?
Nope.
Well, there you go. They're documented, and so the formal banking structure also has a shadow.
Could it be argued that the reason I haven't heard of it, and indeed many other people have not heard of it, is because it's a ludicrous conspiracy theory?
The reality is we have got sufficient, substantiated, factual material that these organizations are real, and obviously because they're so powerful, they try to operate in the shadows. Who said education, education, education? But we can't rely on the official media. We cannot. Because if you take what I've just been arguing, that you've got a very powerful financial elite, it means the political elite, political parties, their funding comes eventually from the same guys. They fund multinationals, as well as having their own money, which feeds into the party system. So people like in this country, never mind America, your Cleggs, your Camerons, they are mouthpieces of the bankers.
Well, it's an interesting view there from Mohin Yassin from the Islamic think tank Global Vision 2000. But what about this charge, Martin? That much of this we're seeing is about actually stamping out a kind of competitive type of banking system to the Western one.
Well, I think that's... I mean, I agree with most of what Mohim was saying there, actually. I mean, people have got to understand that the way the world works is on the petrodollar system. That is to say that if you want to buy oil, you've got to have dollars, which allows the US to manipulate the whole of the international system to their to the benefit of their elite. And what is being suggested now, for example, in Iran, where they're going to have sanctions on them, they are thinking of selling their oil in either euros, gold, or rubles. The Chinese, the Russians, the Libyans at one stage were talking about we've got to get out, away from having all oil bought in dollars. Because, of course, if you do set up an oil market which isn't done in dollars, then the possibility it then becomes quite possible for the US to simply collapse, its geopolitical position to be completely undermined. And that's why they're going to war, to keep the petrodollar system. Because if they don't keep the petrodollar system, the US economy is toast.
But surely that's not true for places like Libya.
Libya was going to price its oil in Libyan gold dinars, and that was one of the reasons why the global elite decided that it was time to invade Libya.
So they want everybody in debt. Is this what Mohim seems to be implying there?
Yes.
I mean, for example, Colonel Gaddafi, we heard last week, he built an incredible water system, which was the man-made river system, bringing water thousands of miles, fresh water, without actually incurring any debt whatsoever. It was all from his oil revenues.
Yeah, I mean, Libya was one of the few third world countries that wasn't in debt because of the oil, and they therefore had an independent policy. Not anymore, I suspect.
Now, Mohim mentioned these sort of so-called conspiracy theory groups here, such as the Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission. Now, I mean, I've done a website about the Bilderbergs, which is bilderberg.org. But what are your thoughts about this, Martin? To what extent do these kind of shadowy groups actually have much power, or are they just kind of talking shops?
Well, I mean, they do have power. The elite do get together and decide what they would like to do, and they have private meetings and they have more public
meetings.
And
do they really do what he was saying there at the very end, when he was saying that they are paying the political parties, they are paying for the politicians?
Absolutely. I mean, look at the US presidential election campaign at the moment. Wealthy individuals are chucking huge amounts of money at the campaign to get the results they want. And that is why there is no serious attempt to regulate Wall Street, because Wall Street funds the political process in the US on the back of taxpayer money. So the taxpayers bail out Wall Street. Wall Street then uses the money to buy the politicians, and the politicians do what Wall Street wants, even though it's the taxpayers' money that Wall Street's spending, and nobody can do anything about it. And that's really shocking. I mean, we need political leadership in the US, which is of global stature, and what we've got is a corrupt system bought by wealthy insiders, many of whom actually should be in prison, never mind running the country.
Now, we were talking there briefly about this whole idea of sort of financial warfare. Do you think this is a... I mean, you remember back in the 1930s, everyone was biting their nails about air power, bombers and things like that. We had Guernica in the Spanish Civil War. Everyone was saying, well, crikey, you know, how are we going to cope with air power? Now, there are other sorts of power being employed, aren't there? I would even suggest things like cyber warfare, this kind of thing. Yeah. It's going to be a very different battle if it does happen, God forbid, doesn't it?
Well, it's already happening. I mean, I've just read a very interesting book about financial warfare called The Oil Card. I can't remember the chap who's written it. I should have brought the book in if I was going to quote from it. But basically saying that the oil price has been manipulated. It was manipulated downwards in the 1980s to smash the Soviet Union, and it's being manipulated upwards now to frustrate the Chinese. And if the oil price, the petrodollar system, is not a free market, then there is no free market, because that's the most important price in the economy apart from the interest rate. So the two most important prices in the economy, the interest rate and the price of oil, are completely manipulated. Therefore, there is no free market. It's all financial warfare.
Okay, that book, by the wonders of technology, I can tell you, is The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century by James R. Norman. So tell us a bit more about that.
It was a very interesting book, very interesting book. Basically, he's making the case that most of what we see is actually a result of geopolitical manoeuvring, so that the oil price, they've deregulated the oil futures market, which allows dark players to enter the market and carry on pushing the price of oil up or down as required. And we went through a whole phase of the oil price being forced down so that the Soviet Union ran out of foreign currency and eventually collapsed. Now the oil price is being artificially pushed up, so a war with Iran that pushes the oil price up would be good, because it basically frustrates the Chinese, who haven't got
In what way does a high oil price frustrate the Chinese?
Because they've only got minimal amounts of oil inside China, and they've got a very, very hungry economy that needs lots of oil. So they've got a problem. They had loads of oil wells in Libya. The Chinese national oil companies were in Libya, but they've had to take all of their people out during the fighting, and they're never going back. It's all going to be BP now, and so on.
Interesting. Okay, so ultimately, though, surely it's impossible to win just on a war, just on the economics. And the petrodollar is not going to survive, is it?
No, the petrodollar may not survive, and that's possibly what World War III is going to be about, whether it's going to survive or not. But the idea that finance is some kind of financial warfare is as old as the hills and as new as this morning. And wars are won and lost about over money. You know, the people who've got the dosh generally win, and the people who haven't generally lose.
Now, there's another aspect to all of this, which has been much more employed since World War II. I mean, it started really in the First World War, which is psychological warfare. The one of the main places in Britain where army officers are trained up to do psychological warfare is at 15 Group Psychological Operations in Chicksands. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, how does this kind of thing work, Martin? Because what they're boasting, I had a look at their website last week, they're boasting that they can actually make an enemy give up before a single shot has been fired. And isn't this the argument now, that they're saying, rather than killing people, it's better to lie to them through psychological warfare and attack their consciousness in a way, their minds, so that we don't need to have anybody killed?
Well, I think that's disingenuous. I mean, psychological warfare, again, is as old as the hills. Alexander the Great was a great psychological warfare expert.
What did he do?
What he did is he basically, he was a great PR man. So when he cut the Gordian knot, that created a nice story. And he gave the story, he liked to have the myth of invincibility, that he was actually the son of a god. This is as old as the hills. But of course, what happened after World War II is that governments like the British and the US governments and the Russians, for example, spent billions on training people up. Psychological warfare was not just left to chance. It became, a business, an industry, and it still is. And of course, it's not directed necessarily at your enemies, it's directed at your own population to bamboozle them to go along with what you want them to do. And that's a very important function of it.
Do you think there's a problem? That's almost like the Watergate syndrome, isn't it? Where spies, instead of being used against foreign powers, are used against your democratic competitors citizens.
It's 1984, isn't it? And we are living in 1984 today. We're going to move from living in Brave New World, where we're just being kept quiet with consumer goods, to 1984, where we're going to be kept quiet with a bullet boot in the face.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much. Now, a month or so ago, we were blessed with the presence of Geneva's CERN Particle Accelerator, the Higgs boson places, former computer expert Sabine McNeil. Sabine is now fighting miscarriages of justice, partly using a website called Victims Unite. Well, she identifies the police as in the best position to stop these miscarriages of justice by doing the unthinkable, that is, prosecuting crooked lawyers and other police. She also talks of a mysterious phone call from someone calling himself a modern-day Knights Templar, and we're going to finally hear that now.
So far, the whole dishonest money system has been war-fueled and aimed at wars. So hopefully, that is becoming less and less popular by now as well. But we'll have to see who is stronger, everything that Occupy symbolizes or everything the global elite wants to push through. But there's a great political consultant, a Polish guy, Brudzinski, who said, there's a global awakening, a global political awakening. So he's warning the elite. So maybe...
So Brzezinski, used to run Carter's foreign policy.
Yeah.
And so he made a speech to a global elite audience saying, look, you've got a problem now. You've got all these people are waking up. What are we going to do about it?
Yes. And that's where hopefully your community radio contributes as well to the solution. Because the solutions are available and are possible.
But what about the dark solution? Because this is what concerns me. And I think it's important that people are able to recognise it if it does appear over the horizon. I mean, we're seeing a situation with the economy now where people are slowly being driven further into poverty with less and less disposable income, maybe possibly evicted from their homes, all this kind of thing, with these changes to the government benefit cuts. I suppose you could phrase them attacks on handicapped, disabled people through the benefit system, etc. This is actually a sort of situation that there was in Germany back in between the First World War and the Second World War, terrible economic conditions, which could actually lead, potentially anyway, pave the way to a new Hitler.
Well, the Hitlers are already all in place, aren't they? They just aren't recognized as that. There are people who know more than I do about how Hitler was financed.
Yeah, but I mean, Hitler was obviously in rebellion, if you like, against the free market philosophy of the West of the time. Roosevelt also was also rebelling against it in a different way, and both of them were democratically elected.
And there were elements in Wall Street, weren't there, that helped actually finance rise of the Nazi Party?
Yeah, there were indeed. And I think the real danger is that when we really get into the crisis, as we will this year, I think, that people will be shocked and stunned and therefore suggestible, and people will come along not with sensible solutions like your green credit for green
purposes,
but with crazy things like the real problem is we've got too many immigrants from Eastern Europe
whatever.
It's much easier for people to understand that.
Yes.
They can see the neighbour down the street who they don't like, whose food smells funny to them or whatever. Trying to explain to them how the global elite is manipulating everything is much more complicated and it's much easier, and people will grasp at straws. They will. And I think that the global elite are banking on this, that when the crisis and the crash takes place and everything starts to go bad, and far worse than it is now, it's bad now but it's going to get worse, that people won't be rational, they won't be calm,
they won't
do sensible things,
sure
they will be
true.
Prey to all kinds of stupid ideas. And obviously what we try to do with our show every week, Tony, is to educate people about the issues so that they are aware of what's at stake and they don't believe everything that they hear in the mainstream media, but you can see what the problem is going to be.
Right, Sabine, one of the things which would be really useful to hear from you is if it looks like you're in a situation where there are threats to your family, legal threats or to your business, what should you actually do? Because it seems to me you're saying if you're going to go to the legal system, it could suck you in without a trace.
Absolutely. It is completely tragic what is happening, and it has happened to more victims than anybody knows, because it's such a shame to be a victim. Yeah. So and most lots of people kill themselves, lots of people die from stress and get ill and so on. So those who survive and become star fighters are the ones who I kind of talk to. So who can do what? Well, for example, one solution is to become a litigant in person. And I've got a colleague who set up a company called Help for Lips. And his advice is mainly, first of all, don't get into a court at all. For God's sake, don't believe that you'll ever get justice in any court. Secondly, get as much help as you can to get out of courts once you're
in
there.
So this is essentially saying that it may be a bad idea to get in with a solicitor that you don't necessarily know, because they may not be working in your interest. So if you're a litigant in person, you're representing yourself.
Yes, but you see, you have to really learn how to present your case and to become rational about such emotional and financial and psychological hurt. It's very hard and very, very difficult. That's why I've built Victims Unite, and that's where people help each other. I mean, it helps to at least be heard, at least to see your story, and to see yourself and your story as a video.
And also learn not to make the same mistakes as people have made in the past.
Yeah, and the mistake is trust. You tend to trust people and then they turn out to be crooks. And when that happens with so-called established authorities and so-called professionals, and professionals don't lie, and you get a gagging order, which is false, which is fake, where court stamps are falsified, then you wonder and ask yourself, what do you do? Who am I to take a local counsel to a court? But that's effectively what I should be doing, at least with three councils. Who are the women and the parents whose children are taken? At night, 10:30, 12-year-old girl taken out of her bed. Where does she go to? She has written 35 letters to the judges and the social service. Please hear me. Please take me home. Who hears them? The judge ignores them. How can you do that? I visited a woman whose eighth child has been taken. She was abused herself when she was 5 to 12. She said she stepped in for her cousin who was younger. Is it surprising? Then she hurts when her children are taken one by one. But she learns. She's becoming a star fighter. She's defending herself as a litigant in person.
So what about your website for Victims Mutual Support? Where can we find that?
Victims-unite.net. has had over 80,000 hits, nearly 2,000 comments, and 298 followers last time I checked. And it has quite a few cases and stories published with names, but I'm setting up a next new site, which I call the Citizen Cyber Court, where nameless stories will be published and people are invited to play jury or juror or by polling. I'll see how it goes. But I'm collecting cases for that. And because I consider child snatching cases are the tip of this monumental iceberg of white-collar crimes, I'm starting with child snatching cases. I've got the first four write-ups. And so there's also a great start because the Education Select Committee is investigating child protection. So
now, I'm fascinated by how you've transferred skills from something like CERN, you know, Geneva, to this new network. How did your what you learned as part of your studying in computers and networks there help?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have a mind which is as sharp as a computer. My logic is sharp, and therefore I see what's wrong, what's right, and what follows and what doesn't follow. And I can manage and manipulate software a bit more easily than others who struggle with clicking here and seeing that there. And I just feel passionate about things, and it turns me on to do something. And if you know, why should I run around from editor to editor and to publish a book? It's much more effective to publish another blog and another petition and gather information and gather signatures and inform people this way.
So would you consider yourself as an engineer? Because I worked with a chap who was an engineer who then started working up for the Green Party in the European Parliament. And he said to me, well, the trouble with the European Parliament and the European system, as an engineer, I look at it and I think this is a machine that will never work.
I describe myself more as a cybernetic thinker and a systems analyst, but I have found that engineers understand me much, much better than any theoretical scientist. The fact that systems don't work is certainly not recognized by most people, because most people don't have holistic views at all, and looking at systems means looking at holistically.
But do you think some of these systems, the legal system for example, keep quite a lot of themselves out of the public eye deliberately?
I don't know to what degree it's deliberate. It's sort of like the medics. They have their own language, and the deliberate aspect, I think, comes only in with the Freemasons that I just heard when I came in here. The fact that these societies are secret, the fact that 87% of all judges are Freemasons, makes me very suspicious.
Are they?
Somebody keeps telling me that there was I don't know where it was published, but they have admitted. The police didn't want to admit it, but the judges have admitted, and 87% of them. And I got an anonymous phone call the other day from somebody who was clearly a Templar. He said to me that the country has always been run like this for 700 years, and don't you dare to touch it, basically, you know. Drop some of the posts on your websites.
Okay, you better remind us what those websites are again.
Thank you, Tony. Victims-unite.net, citizenscybercourt.wordpress.com. I didn't register a domain for that yet. But the most important one, I mean, my plea to the government and anybody who wants to care for the country is EDM 1297. That's about the enforcement of the Bank of England Act 1694, because the people who wrote that act, they wanted to avoid the serious oppression by their Majesty's subjects by writing that act. And you know what? They foresaw a punishment in it, because they didn't want the corporation to trade. And if they were to trade, they would have to pay treble the value of the transaction. So theoretically, the Bank of England should pay treble the value of all of the national debts. Now, that would be a positive solution.
That was Sabine McNeill there speaking to me a month or so ago, and she was former head of computer networking at Geneva's CERN, the particle accelerator. Martin, just briefly, what she was talking about there, the country has been run this way for 700 years and don't you dare mess with it. Is that feasible?
Well, there are old elites and new elites, and we're now in a situation where the financial fraud elite is basically going to suck up all the money and leave everybody else with nothing, and that will be a revolutionary situation.
Okay, thank you. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night. 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party crew, followed by the UFO show. But if you prefer something live, Martin's got something for you.
Yes, the something called the International School for Bottom-Up Organising have got a gig on tonight in Stokescroft at the Arts House, 108A Stokescroft. It's a benefit for a community in Colombia which has been oppressed, in Villarrica. And there'll be performances from Lindsay Rose Inman, Asafo Gayata, Chloe Lang and Kev the Poet, and special guests. And that's on this evening at the Arts House, 108A Stokescroft, a benefit for people in Colombia.
What time?
It doesn't give a time here, but I presume it's sort of 7, 8 sort of time.
OK, well, thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That was MEP for the UK Independence Party, William Dartmouth. Also to Daphne Havercroft from the South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group, SHWAG. And to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times at the BCFM website. That's www.bcfm.org.uk. Or go directly to our page. You can just type in this week. .org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.